for today is a case of William Edward Freeman in Commonwealth, Virginia. Counsel. Fortunately, we don't need any interpreters for this case, I don't think, so. So are you ready to proceed? Mr. Downs?
Good morning, we have the appellant. My name is David Downs. I would ask to reserve 3 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Let's start with a question we pose, because to me that's your insurmountable hurdle. The U.S. Supreme Court has on multiple occasions held that a police officer is entitled to rely upon a facially valid statute, even if that statute is later found to be unconstitutional. There's no court, to the best of my knowledge, that had held that the dangling object statute was unconstitutional on the day of your client's arrest. Why does the exclusionary rule apply?
Well, I first point to the trial transcript where it appears that the law of the case is that it would apply.
Now, the law of the case doesn't apply on appellate review of a trial court.
Unless, of course, we send it back for remand and it comes up a second time. And I'm jumping the gun in that respect. The issue was right in front of Judge Wetzel when I argued in front of Clark County Circuit Court, and he first took the position that it's not void for vagueness because the respective honors spent 27 pages discussing it and implicitly found it not to be vague, even though in the Humphreys three-judge panel, two out of one judges held, well, they didn't raise it below, so we can't consider it now, which was a nice green light for those of us practicing in the trenches to think maybe we should raise this issue. At least that's all this.
But your client was not charged with a violation of the statute, was he?
That is correct.
So your only standing to challenge the constitutionality is to kind of come in the back door saying that the police officer couldn't rely on it because it was facially unconstitutional.
Well, I would like to think that I could argue that it was actually as applied to him, arising out of the basis for the stop, but for that officer's interpretation of 46.2.1054, he would not have been stopped. Assuming arguendo,
but it's not just the officer's interpretation. No court has ever interpreted that statute differently than the officer did. Why can't he rely on a facially valid statute?
Oh, just to be clear, I think I punted this issue when the court asked me to special brief it. I specifically came out and said, I think this is a loser argument in light of Pine versus North Carolina. In fact, I cited it in my reply brief because I don't want to take up the court's time on an issue I'm going to lose. What my fallback position on is to, in effect, follow my sword for purposes of other practitioners and, in some respects, follow the Sixth Circuit's opinion where they held, we got to straighten this out and at least make a ruling on the constitutionality of whether the statute is vague or not, and then we're going to decide the exclusionary rule doesn't apply.
Why do we need to, in this case, even go down that road? And you obviously are an experienced practitioner, and I would imagine that in your practice or criminal practice, you've had a litany of cases, particularly DUI cases, where people are weaving in and out of traffic or weaving in the lane or whatever the police officer says, and that provides the basis for the officer to stop the vehicle and then engage in whatever officers do once they perceive someone who may be driving under the influence. Why aren't the facts of this case just like DUI cases we see every day in trial courts?
Because in this case, if you turn to the very last page of the appendix, you see Exhibit 4, which is the viewpoint of the so-called dangling object from the driver's point of view. That's the testimony can't help but feel some empathy with the five-judge minority in the en banc Mason decision, where they go, we've got thousands of traffic regulations.
But Mason had nothing to do with the constitutionality of the statute. Mason had nothing to do with whether the statute was wise or not. Mason simply dealt with the fact that the police officer, whether the police officer needed to have a reasonable suspicion that not only was the object dangling, but it also impacted the view of the road.
Correct, which gets me back to the void for vagueness argument. I didn't mean to jump ahead because I was addressing the second issue now on appeal before the Virginia Supreme Court in Mason in review of that case, whether or not there's reasonable or suspicion based on a reasonable interpretation of the statute, regardless of whether you find it to be unconstitutional or not, the void for vagueness doctrine. Back to void for vagueness. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the Heine opinion. I think I'm ultimately going to lose that because I don't think this court can expect to hold a police officer to a higher standard of the legislature and the governor who signed the bill into effect and then go, well, police officer, you should have known better. And I'm not going to ask the court to make that finding because I don't think that would probably be ludicrous against the Supreme Court opinion. What we did have in this case, and I suggested it in my brief in response to this court's inquiry, is, well, maybe if you're not going to accept my law of the case argument, if you ran me into that, because Judge Wetzel made it very clear in the record that if he found it void for vague, he would apply the exclusionary rule.
Well, that would be plain error, wouldn't it?
I tried to argue with Judge, which my fallback position was, Judge, let me argue it. And he goes, you made your record, Mr. Downs, and we have this colloquy that goes on that's rather spirited. And to give you just a little brief background, it was Judge Wetzel who decided the Penn case, which was frequently cited in circuit court opinion, dealing with the dangling object back in the city of Winchester, also 26th Judicial. That was 3 months after another case, that was my case, the Rocky Watts case, where he reversed himself and referenced that counsel as had been
disastrous. We could get back to the question that I asked earlier.
Yes, sir.
It says, at joint appendix at page 131, this is the testimony, as appellant made a right turn onto Crumbs Church Road, he observed appellant's vehicle weaving over the center line. Specifically, his three left tires cross over the center line of Crumbs Church Road. He was concerned because Crumbs Church Road was a narrow roadway and appellant was weaving, could have caused a collision with oncoming traffic. That's joint appendix at 131. He believed he had reasonable suspicion to stop for a DUI.
Yes, sir.
Why do we need to go down this? And I was in the dissent on the Mason case, so you've got an ally, theoretically, with regard to the issue. But if we look at the issue that we have in this particular case, why isn't the weaving in traffic enough to stop all this inquiry about that?
Then give me a chance to answer that. Because my cross-examination following that was, well, officer, why wasn't your report that was such an important basis for the probable cause or reasonable suspicion to stop? It wasn't. It was a narrow road. This was an individual that they were looking for and basically looking for just a hodgepodge of his excuses as to why to stop him. And he's going down this rural road. They've been watching him all day because they suspect he's dealing drugs. And the Commonwealth doesn't even adopt that argument, doesn't follow it.
The court was more interested in the dangling object than the traditional basis for people being pulled over.
Not only more interested, but in 50 plus pages of transcript, never, ever even acknowledges that as a basis for the suppression. Using Judge Wetzel's very same logic, if a court's going to spend 27 pages discussing one issue and not the other, implicitly, they've rejected that as a basis.
Mr. Downs, before we leave assignment of error number one, I'd like you to address for just a moment the Attorney General's argument that there is an alternative ruling by the trial court. The object was in the shape of a hand grenade.
Yes.
The trial judge made a finding, a ruling, that any reasonable police officer would stop the car to investigate whether this was actually an explosive device, and whether or not a correct statement, and I understand the evidence is not real strong to support that, it was unappealed by you.
A couple of points. First, with respect to the basis for the stop, the officer's testimony was unequivocal.
He didn't see it.
He saw air fresheners.
It may have been a wrong and erroneous ruling that was not supported by the evidence, but it was not appealed, so it becomes a unappealed finding of the court that we can't review.
A couple of points. First, I'd point out that The issue was fairly broadly stated. It was a reasonable thinking suspicion to conduct the stop. I'm addressing the response. What's interesting is it was never raised by the Commonwealth. It's never raised as a justification in any of the argument for me to respond. It's at the conclusion where the court, sui sponte, raises the issue, and perhaps in fairness, it was this late in the morning.
And if you had appealed that, I would conclude that it was plainly wrong and without evidence to support it, because the officer said, I didn't see what it was. But it wasn't appealed, so it is a finding by the trial court that we cannot review.
I said I couldn't appeal it, because to do otherwise would have the appellant would be forced to point to the record as to where did you object when this evidence came in. Clearly, there's never an opportunity. If the court would just put themselves in my shoes just for a moment, imagine the judge giving his reason, and then out of the blue, he goes, well, it could have been a grenade, which is pretty much how I responded at the time. Grenade? Over. It would have been inappropriate for me to go, Your Honor, I object to the court's finding.
Why? Your Honor, there's no evidence to support the theory that the police officer thought that that was a grenade. Why isn't that an appropriate objection?
The transcript I would humbly submit speaks for itself with respect to dialogue between myself and Judge Wetzel, constantly discussing the other issues, if you will. At this point, I thought I had preserved it with the argument that there was simply no reasonable or deep suspicion. When there was a response brought up for the first time, I don't have the opportunity to raise the objection. In hindsight, Judge Petty, I wish I'd done that. That certainly would, in anticipation of this argument, would have made more sense. I truly thought it was encompassed with my broader argument. There was no reasonable or deep suspicion for the stop to begin with. That was a response, albeit not supported by the record, sui sponte by the trial judge.
Okay, moving to your second assignment of error, that there was no, that that dangling air freshener wasn't sufficient to block the view of the highway, and therefore there was no reasonable suspicion to stop the car. Isn't that pretty much answered by our en banc opinion in Mason? This is clearly bigger than the small parking pass in Mason.
I would submit it doesn't, because size is simply one factor. And you see that in all the other state courts that have addressed that it's simply one factor. Imagine, if you will, and I recognize these aren't the facts, but if it were a basketball, albeit suspended over to the far right side of my windshield, does that in fact obstruct my...
But how does the police officer determine that? And isn't that the purpose for the stop, to investigate the reasonable suspicion that it might block the view?
Well,
I mean, that's what Mason said.
Well, of course, before the car before the courts, we first to have initially have to have a reasonable articulable suspicion to conduct the stop in the first place. Normally, you have this language of, based on my experience and training, I would know that sitting in the driver's seat with that size of an object would obstruct my view of the highway, as I understand the local courts have interpreted the highway. I'm on Mason's side of the dissent, so I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about footnotes as to the expansive definition and dictum as to what highway now encompasses.
That's Justice Kelsey's opinion.
Justice,
you might want to not refer to it as dictum at this point.
Well, yes, sir. I'm also pleased. I think he's going to be excluded at Mason before the Supreme Court. We don't know what the future may hold.
You're hoping for help in the Supreme Court? Is that what you're saying?
I don't want to waste my time. You had a good question with respect to reasonable people's suspicion, and then I got into this dialogue about, well, his experience in training. Well, I don't know of any academy saying this is the training for what's dangling and obstructs the highway. In fact, Judge Wetzel's opinion in 26 at that point was it was a per se rule, which Mason clearly does not follow.
Well, he made a finding that air freshener would obstruct the vision of any car or the view of any car in America.
He did, which is overbroad beyond the scope of the statute. The statute is limited to the highway, not any view into space, view into who knows where.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time. You can keep talking if you like, but I did want to let you know that you're into your rebuttal time. Yes, sir. Thank you. Ms. Adelphia, what do you have to offer to help us here?
Given the fact that the appellant appellants failed to preserve the challenge to the trial court's alternative ruling that there was reasonable articulable suspicion to stop the vehicle because the defendant had a hamper deed or a period.
Would you agree that that ruling was plainly wrong and without evidence to support it?
I think that that's a fair question. That said, as the Johnson case states, we don't examine the whether the trial court's finding was correct, especially because that it was waived. We examine whether or not, if it was correct, it would be a reason to stop someone to initiate a Terry stop. And certainly, the reasonable articulable suspicion that criminal activity is afoot is a reason to stop the driver.
What criminal activity would you point to?
It was a violation of, the officer could have believed it was a violation of code section.
Let's assume for the sake of discussion, obviously there's no determination in that regard, that the officer's reliance on the dangling object statute does not give him reasonable articulable suspicion. What would you rely on next?
A belief that he had been in violation of 18.2-85.
Okay, how about the weaving?
That is also an acceptable reason, objectively reasonable.
That weaving was never addressed at all by the trial court. Was it? How could we review whether that was sufficient? The officer didn't point to that as a reason to stop a car, and the trial judge never addressed it.
I think that the reliance on the belief that there could be a hand grenade in the car is the better focus of the inquiry, Your Honor. But where there was, in fact, reasonable articulable suspicion under another basis,
so you don't believe the reference that I made, the joint appendix at page 131, where the officer said he believed he had reasonable suspicion to stop for a DUI, does that make it part of the record?
That is part of the record, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but perhaps I just think that the court's explicit finding that there was a hand grenade or what appeared to be a hand grenade present is the stronger argument, and then the comments that fall on this alternate reason to pull over Mr. Freeman, which was the fact that he was believing that there was a chance that he was committing a DUI or had some other driving.
Let me ask you to address the problem I think you probably have with the position that Mr. Downs pretty much concedes decides the case, and that's the reliance on the good faith reliance on a constitutional statute. Apparently, that is a unique concept to the Commonwealth attorney because it was never raised below. Can we decide the case on that basis under the right result, wrong reason, or the tipsy coachman doctrine, as I like to refer to it?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Under Perry versus Commonwealth, that's
not. Why?
Because there is basis in the facts in the record are present for this court to reach that determination, and it is the Commonwealth on appeal is not bound by any arguments made by the Commonwealth.
Are there any factual findings required by the trial court for us to decide the case on that basis? Any factual findings we don't have?
I think, Your Honor, that the trial court's finding that, of course, I think that the, obviously, I'm thinking of the statute, and I was trying to visualize it, are basically the size of the forearm that reach from here all the way down to the.
No, I'm talking about factual findings required to decide the issue of whether there's good faith reliance by the police officer on the statute.
Well, I think that the court's finding that it's reasonable for the officer to believe that the view was obstructed is a factual finding that this court can rely on. Therefore, there was nothing about the statute was flagrantly or grossly vague. This officer was entitled to follow behind the driver and say, well, it's clear, I believe that his view is obstructed by the object's dangling, and I need to stop him. And the court didn't define that these objects. unconstitutional. There's nothing in the language of 1054 that's, that would lead anyone to believe that it was a violation of someone's constitutional rights, especially because in unpublished cases, the appellate courts of Virginia continue to find that that code section had been violated and multiple convictions under that code section. So just to summarize briefly, Hummel's argument, the defendant did not, the appellant did not, or has waived an argument with respect to the court's alternative ruling, and therefore, even if this court was to find in his favor here, the conviction would still need to be affirmed because there was an alternative ruling below. He does not have standing to mount a facial challenge to 1054 because he did not raise an as-applied challenge either below or in this court.
Yeah, let me ask you about that facial versus as applied. This is not a First Amendment issue. This is not a dangling crucifix or anything that would implicate the First Amendment. Is there any case law that would allow us to use an as applied analysis? The facial analysis as opposed to as applied in determining whether the statute's unconstitutional?
I think the courts have repeatedly held that the appellant must first challenge in this case where the as-applied challenge was not made, he does not reach, this court cannot reach the facial challenge of Section 1664. And then finally, with respect to Assignment of Error number 2, the officer had his reasonable suspicion to believe that the defendant was violating 1054. The defendant by counsel acknowledged that the objects were larger than the objects in Mason. They were 3 to 4 objects dangling all the way almost to the dashboard, and the officers testified that they believed that the clear view of the highway would be obstructed. And in fact, as the court noted, the trial court found that the view would be obstructed by anyone who was attempting to make a right.
Which was just to the contrary of actual finding made by the trial court in Mason that this object wouldn't obstruct the view of any car in America.
And I think that the pictures.
Thank you, Counsel. So you have about a minute.
The court in another case mentioned we should not have observed statutes and interpreted them as such. I'm afraid that's what we have before your honors, and I'd ask that this court give us some guidance in the trenches.
You've asked us to use the facial standard in reviewing this statute.
I agree with you, Judge Petty. This was not a crucifix. It wasn't rosary beads. I think I have to do the applied.
Did you argue as applied?
I took the position that I did because of that interpretation as applied to Mr. Freeman that he was stopped. He wasn't charged with the $30 prepayable traffic infraction with no DMV points. Another reason for the need to have this court at some point address it, and this would appear to be the best avenue. The subjective opinion of the officer is exactly what we all agree should not be the basis for the stop, and that's all that's in the record. His opinion. It's not articulable reasonable facts to support that conclusion. Thus, we are like Mason.
Okay, well, let's take that point that you just made a little bit further. Say we have 10 officers, and we have 10 officers who, for whatever reason, are following behind the same theoretical vehicle with a dangling object. Five of them believe that it does not obstruct the rear view, obstruct the driver's view. Five of them believe that it do, that it does. Can't we accept any officer's reasonable interpretation of that and therefore allow the stop to be made?
Based on quantifying, yes, but they need more than that opinion, that subjective opinion. Give the court what the other states have done in their cases of record, Connecticut, Colorado, Massachusetts, and so on, where there are observations made. Moving around, it's so large that he's experienced with things in front of him, it would block.
Well, Mr. Downs, wouldn't you agree that the law is crystal clear that when reviewing whether there is reasonable suspicion that a crime has committed, we employ an objective standard. We determine whether any reasonable police officer or a reasonable police officer would believe that. We don't look at the subjective testimony or intent of the officer involved in this case.
Correct.
Okay.
We'll come down and read counsel. As I look at the docket, this completes the docket for today.